Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithloday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers at ATQ, Adam Holland. How you doing, Adam?
I'm doing well, man. Thanks for having me on. Ready to go over some baseball and some other stuff.
Yeah, let's start out talking about baseball. The baseball team season is not over, although at some point during the Pac-12 tournament, I sort of felt like it was. Just to quickly recap where we're at, this was the inaugural Pac-12 tournament. It was a double elimination tournament, which meant you had to lose two games. It was setting up pretty nicely for the Ducks against Arizona teams that they had just finished beating. You know, they'd taken five games out of six in the last two regular season series. And that was supposed to set them up well to maybe even get a regional hosting site for the NCAA tournament. That NCAA tournament starts this week in a day or two. We're recording on Wednesday night. They did not get a regional hosting site. They flamed right out of the tournament against the Arizona schools. It was quite bizarre. They will be opening their NCAA series against Michigan. The other two schools in the regionals are Louisville, which is the host, and Southeast Missouri State. Let's start out talking about how the Pac-12 tournament went. Adam, what'd you see?
Honestly, in the first game, they dug themselves an early hole, which unfortunately has been kind of common for them. They tend to get themselves in these little ditches that they have to get themselves back out of. The encouraging thing to see was that they did dig themselves back out of it and briefly took the lead. But again, I think it comes down to a lot like what we were talking about in the last podcast and what you've continuously gone over, which is the fact that they don't have that closer. They don't have that ace that can just keep teams from putting up runs. And we saw that happen yet again. As soon as they, you know, were able to go back up, then kind of Arizona just put it away by getting another home run. They, you know, scored some crucial runs down the stretch.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't just the home run. It was that it was a three-run home run because they had, you know, let two guys get on base, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, again, like, you know, when you see that kind of thing happening, then it's usually kind of a recipe for disaster. I was hoping that they could at least kind of redeem themselves in the second game of the series. But then again, in that game, they just couldn't seem to muster a lot of offense.
Yeah, That was sort of the strange thing, was that the first game against Arizona, even though they had just swept Arizona, it still kind of looked like, yeah, I'm familiar with this kind of performance out of the Ducks, where like their batting was exactly what we're used to seeing. They sort of get in a hole and then they light it up against the reliever, you know, scoring six runs. That's about right, you know, for the Ducks. And just the, you know, the pitching couldn't close the deal, you know, like got behind early and then couldn't close the deal. So then I was like, well, all right, their consolation prize is they play Arizona State, a team that they just beat for the first time ever in Tempe in a series in the state of Arizona, which is where they were playing, you know, this one. So I was like, well, all right, but at least they're going to beat, you know, Arizona State. That should be no problem. They're just like the 7 or 8 seed. You know, this should be easy. Nope, they couldn't hit at all. What do you think that was about?
Honestly, you know, I'd like to chalk it up to Arizona State's pitching. I know Arizona State doesn't have elite pitching, but that was just an offensive slump like I have really not seen from Oregon all season. They were 0-for-9 hitting with 2 outs, and they were 1-for-13 when they had guys in scoring position. And yeah, if you're gonna turn in that kind of performance offensively, it's going to be hard to beat anybody. I mean, I know that, you know, it's Arizona State. It's certainly something that seems winnable, but honestly, they picked a bad day to have what I saw as maybe their worst offensive performance of the season.
I mean, they scored runs and they've been shut out in other games. Like, but we've seen that in a couple of games, you know, where it's just like, oh boy, the bats are just ice cold today. You know, it's not quite enough that I worry about it being a structural thing. You know, baseball always plays a long season. Even the best teams have games where they, you know, look like that. But boy, they can't afford to do any of those in regionals. Like, you know, Michigan and Louisville are both pretty good teams. Michigan is coming off of a funny little scandal. I kind of don't think that's going to affect things much. Like, there is no way you get past both of those teams if your bats are ice cold. Cause I mean, that's the Ducks trademark, you know, like they're one of the best hitting teams in the nation, except for the games where they don't hit very well, you know?
Yeah. Well, and then in this case, when you have some of their normally best offensive weapons, you know, like Tanner Smith and Jacob Walsh, each getting one hit apiece for the entire game, with like one RBI between them. That's, yeah. If you see that against any team, you're in trouble. I don't care who it is.
Well, what do you think are the prospects for a turnaround in Louisville?
Honestly, other than getting their offense going, I think it really has to do with making sure that you capitalize with on base players. Kind of one thing that you referred to many times was Oregon's tendency to leave guys stranded on the plays. Okay, so you can say like, oh, we need to pick up our offense. Well, you're producing offense if you're getting guys on base. Even, you know what I mean, if it's just via walks and whatever. The point is you're putting guys on base. So that doesn't seem to be as much of an issue as it does just finishing the job and bringing them in for runs. So I think if you're going to see success in the regionals, that's one thing you have to come through with. If you have guys in on base and especially in scoring position, you have to capitalize on that. There's just not margin for error at this point in the season.
Yeah, it's you know, the one thing that I'll sort of note about this team is that while it has happened, you know, in these sort of isolated moments where the bats just go totally ice cold, that's the, you know, to the extent that we've seen a pattern, that's been the pattern, is that A, it's fairly isolated, and B, like there's no in between with this team. You know, they're either hitting, you know, an absurd number of runs, or that, you know, they aren't putting anybody on base, you know, like, you know, the getting guys home thing doesn't really bother me. As long as you're getting guys on base, then you're doing the right thing. And then it's just a matter of, you know, the more guys you put on base, the more guys that you're, you know, putting into scoring position, the more guys you put into scoring position, the higher the odds of, you know, bringing them home. And like, unless that number really gets out of whack, you know, like unless they're stranding, you know, a ton of folks, like, you know, you're going to wind up like, you know, what does it usually work out to that you get about, you know, half as many runs as you get hits. Like, as long as that's not totally out of whack, like, you know, it feels terrible to say like, oh, they, you know, they stranded all these dudes. But like, as long as it's within the norm, like that's, you know, fine. The question is getting guys on. And that was the thing that was just like, you know, so disturbing about that Arizona State performance. But the silver lining is they usually, you know, over the course of this season have sort of been able to put that away. And they go right. I mean, like, we've been in this spot a couple of times, you know, this season where it's just like, oh my God, where did the Ducks bats go? Is this going to presage like the rest of the season where, you know, all, you know, everything up until this point was a mirage and really the bats are ice cold from now on out. And like, that just hasn't been the case, you know, like they usually bounce back. I mean, hell, the Pac-12 tournament doesn't mean anything. They were going to get wiped out by Oregon State or Stanford anyway. Maybe it was the plan all along. They just wanted to go home and get an early rest, get prepared for Louisville. What do you think about that theory?
It could be. And it's, you see that sometimes. You see it in a lot, in basketball as well. You know, you'll see a team have a great season, and then in the conference tournament, they'll purposely just kind of fizzle out because they're like, no, we just don't need this right now. You know, we've got our positioning and we need rest and we need to, you know, prepare for what's ahead. I can see them doing that. I can see them doing that to avoid a matchup with Oregon State or Stanford, you know, that would put them even further behind. So in a sense, you know, it's okay. It's disappointing just from a strictly competitive standpoint. But from a strategic standpoint, it's definitely not something unheard of or something that you don't see across college athletics.
Huh. I was kind of joking about that, but you took that seriously. That's interesting. Have you looked at all at Michigan or Louisville? Any idea of what Oregon's facing? We're going to have an article later in the week previewing the regional opponents, but I want to know if you've got any take on them right now.
Mostly for Michigan, what I've seen from them is that, kind of like you said, they're in the middle of a little bit of a scandal right now. I mean, you know, maybe not a full scandal, but something that's distracting them. One thing that you can look at when you take a look at the consistency of their winning percentage, because, you know, you look at their winning percentage and you think to yourself, well, you know, they're not super impressive. They have a losing record on the road. They're 500 in conference. You know, overall they're just six games above 500. I think the one thing that you want to look at with them is how often that they've been on any sort of a streak. Because when you look at Oregon baseball, you can look at it as kind of like they've had a season of streaks. They'll have, you know, a lot of wins in a row, and then they'll compile a lot of losses in a row. And that shows that at least you can find some consistency with, you know, getting hot and staying hot, which is, you know, obviously something you're hoping for heading into the NCAAs. With Michigan, I don't see quite as much of that as I do with Oregon. It looked like they did kind of have a little bit of a hot streak going, kind of somewhere around the midseason where they compiled some wins together, put together a nice little streak. But then it fizzled out into a few more losses. And then other than that one right in the middle of the season, I don't see any consistent winning streak from them that spans any more than like three games. And so I think that's one thing to look at is how consistent is this team? How are they with being able to play at a high enough level that they can continue to put win after win after win after win together? And that's just not something I've seen a lot from Michigan. So it gives me confidence heading into that.
Yeah, they're, you know, it was funny because the game that everybody wound up watching, because it was when one of their pitchers got ejected for the game for having a foreign substance, in his glove or something, or his belt or something. So everybody was like, Michigan was the villain of the day. It was in a game in which they were beating Iowa like 15-1, so everybody looked up at the scoreboard, was like, damn, maybe this Michigan team, why were they cheating? They didn't need to cheat. But look up their RPI. Like, it's not great. I think they're 61, in RPI, and Iowa's, only 60. So beating the snot out of them is, not saying much. Oregon's at 28. In RPI, they're not a half bad team at all. They play in a very difficult conference. Obviously the Pac-12 has, two of the top three teams in the country in Oregon State and Stanford. Assuming that nominal Oregon and nominal Michigan show up, I sort of have that one penciled in as a win. But Louisville looks real tough to get past. Louisville's number 17 in RPI. They've got, I think they've got, the ACC is a brutal conference. I think they've got like 8 teams in the top 20. Let me see if I can count them up. North Carolina, Virginia Tech, Wake Forest are all like top 6 teams. Notre Dame's a top 15 team. Miami's a top 15 team. Louisville 17. Georgia Tech is 21. Virginia's 24. The ACC was a totally brutal conference this year. Louisville's conference record is not, the highest in the world, but they were playing a real tough conference, and their RPI, really demonstrates it. I sort of see this going like Oregon beats Michigan, loses to Louisville. Kind of like how softball looked like, beating Wichita State, losing to Arkansas. What do you think about that take?
I think it's fairly accurate. I don't, given the, like I said, kind of like the struggles sometimes with the batting and then just the inconsistency in pitching and ability to close, I don't see them being able to take Louisville. And it's one of the things that's kind of disappointing about their, performance in the Pac-12 tournament, as you were just talking about, is, they had a chance to set themselves up with a better position and better seating where they wouldn't have to face a team like Louisville so soon. But that's what happens. If you don't show up for every game, then you're going to give yourself a position where you're going to be, right in line with one of the better teams. And, yeah, I agree. I think we should probably be able to get past Michigan. Like I said, I don't see a lot of consistency from them. Their winning percentage isn't super high. So I think we'll just kind of have to hang our hat, pardon the pun on that, for the year, is that we were able to make the NCAAs. We were able to, get a win out of it. But there's a lot of room for growth still, and a lot of ways to go before we can really be a true contender.
I think that's probably true. The bright side, though, is that, the game theory of baseball, if you're going to do one thing well in baseball and always have, a shot, it's putting guys on base. Of all the things to if you're going to max out one stat, that's it. And Oregon's a very good batting team most of the time. All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk a little golf and track and field.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So, just to recap, since we were recording in the middle of the Women's Golf National Championship game last week, Slurms and I were, the outcome of that, it came down to match play. Oregon was ranked number 2. Stanford was ranked number 1. They were tied 2-2 with 1, match left. Stanford's Rose Zhang, who I believe had won the individual national championship against Sophie Kibsgaard-Nielsen. Zhang pulled it out by a couple of strokes. Plus, there was a weird scandal where Sophie ran over Zhang's ball on the course, which was ruled a one-stroke penalty, and that gave her plenty of cushion in order to close it out. So Stanford wins 3-2, but Oregon was like, this is a podcast, and so you can't see my fingers. Imagine my fingers being a centimeter apart. They were this close. You know, it was, you know, a pretty damn impressive performance. And I think that Oregon women's golf is going to be back in the national championship scene pretty quick. On the men's golf side, that just wrapped up. Similar structure. They made it in the field of 30. They had an impressive showing in the regionals. They had a big comeback and managed to qualify for it. They made it through the first gate, the round of 30 to the round of 15. Then they had to do stroke play, and they came in 15th out of 15. So they did not make it to match play, which requires making it to the top eight, but number 15 in the country is not bad. Oregon men's golf has won a national championship in the past under this coaching staff, Casey Martin. And again, I think that Oregon men's golf is going to be back in the national stage, you know, sooner rather than later as well. I think this was a pretty good season. Who knew Oregon was a golf school? Do you know that, Adam?
You know, I never would have pegged them as such, but yeah, given the success that we've seen lately, let's call it Golf Town USA. Why not?
Well, I would have figured that this was a track school, and indeed it is. They won the Pac-12, both the men and the women, that was hosted at Hayward Field. Then they went to Fayetteville for the West qualifier, in which the Ducks did very well, qualified a whole bunch of people for the NCAA, you know, championships. That's going to be next week, I believe, the 8th through 11th, and where else but Hayward Field. Hell of a home field advantage, wouldn't you say?
Oh yeah, definitely. And you know, Hayward Field has always been kind of like the home of some of the championships and preliminary qualifyings and all that stuff. I think the remodel, although it was, you know, a little disappointing for some Duck fans to see, just because of, you know, you're getting rid of such a historic venue, has really helped bring it into the limelight as kind of like the place to be. You know, we call ourselves Track Town for a reason, and so we want to have a venue that lines up with that. And so hosting these big events, I think, will definitely be a good home field advantage for Oregon. But also, it gives the school a little more notoriety, too, because you get, you know, national coverage. And anytime you can get national coverage from a little place like Eugene, it's always a plus.
The men qualified seven individuals, and then the 4x100 meter relay is Bienenfield in the 5,000 and 10,000 meters, Elliot Cook in the 1,500 meters, Ty Hampton the javelin, Luis Peralta at 800 meters, Max Vollmer the decathlon, Manuel Himeji in the triple jump. The star I thought of the show was Micah Williams, who just had an absolutely scorching performance in the 100 meters. What'd you think about that?
Yeah, definitely was impressed with Micah Williams' time. Also want to give a shout out to Elliot Cook too as well. You mentioned him. He turned in a lifetime best performance in the 1500 meters. This was definitely the best race I've seen him run. He finished with a time of 3:38.92, and that was almost two full seconds off his previous best. And seeing those kind of performances and getting guys like this into the NCAA championships is obviously, like, you know, a big push for the school and whatnot. Yeah, when it comes to the Micah Williams, not only did he help the team in the 4x100 meter relays, but then getting that spot in the 100 meter field, at the championships and finishing in under 10 seconds with that 9.86. Yeah, he really was kind of the star of the show. And I think he's going to be great in the championships. I think we have a real chance to bring home some more individual gold as well, coming off the heels of that team sweep with the men and the women.
Yeah, it should be, you know, interesting to watch. And then on the other side, the women did even better. They qualified 14 individuals, 9 different events. Eamon Clark in the 200 meters, Jaden Mays in the and Kevin Melson in the 100 meters. Izzy Thornton Bott in the 1500. In the Jasmine Montgomery also in the 100 and the 200 as well. Alexander Webster in the 400 meter hurdles. Malia Pivik in the 3000 meter steeplechase. The other 4x100 meter relay also qualified. That's Jaden Mays, Kevin Wilson, Jasmine Reed, Jasmine Montgomery. I have been putting up on Addicted to Quack all these pictures of Jaden Mays and Kevin Nelson. They just like they show up just looking incredible in photos. It's fantastic for the site. And then in the field events, Jada Ross in the shot put and the discus, and Minna DeClercq in the shot put, and Lexi Ellis in the triple jump. Very impressive performance. I can't remember how this compares to previous performances, but you know, this is the most that I can remember in recent memory. You know, this is a pretty incredible women's track and field team. I think they're going to go pretty far. What do you think, Adam?
Yeah, absolutely. 14 qualifiers is something else. And yeah, I think the women, after you know, kind of like failing to take the Pac-12 team championships up until this year for kind of like a 5-year hiatus.
Yeah, they yielded it to USC. That was no good. Yeah, no, I definitely like how the women are getting back on top again.
Yeah, and Montgomery, you mentioned, she is one of only 2 freshmen in the country to advance right now. So that shows you we have some young blood. And then I also wanted to point out Iman Brown. She recorded a lifetime best performance. And then she has moved up the UO all-time list up to number 8. So quick shout out to her. We got that senior leadership, and now she's stamping her place in the history books for U of O track.
Yeah, no, it was a pretty impressive performance. So the NCAA is coming back to Hayward Field. You can get all the coverage that you can handle at Addicted to Quack. Not like there's a whole lot of other sporting events going on, but track is king, especially this time of year. And it'll be Worlds in July also at Hayward Field. It is a historic and beautiful site. I encourage everybody to go now that the weather's nice. All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk a little football.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
All right, Adam. Obviously, the spring practices have wrapped up, but football never really goes to sleep. This is a pretty prime recruiting period right now. What can you tell us about how the recruiting's going?
Well, I did a couple articles recently related to the recruiting that's going on. In the first article, I had mentioned new UO receivers coach Junior Adams and his effort to kind of fill the gaps in the all the spots that opened up. After you had the departure of so many of UO's top playmakers in the receiver position, I think Adams is doing a great job of filling up those holes. And it kind of plays into like the recruiting efforts of the coaching staff itself, because you know, when you had the previous coaching staff under Cristobal, it wasn't just him, you know, it was the position coaches at Well that were able to kind of like feel like friends and family to the recruits they visited. And so apparently Junior Adams is one of the top in that field. And it's kind of like another nice slap in the face to old UW, because that's where we got him from.
That's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah. Never, you know, when the staff was hired, you know, everybody immediately conceded, oh yeah, these guys can recruit real well, but can any of these guys coach? And then I went and wrote my series about, like, can these guys coach? And I wrote a longer than usual article about Junior Adams because, well, number one, his career is really long. He's been a wide receivers coach and only a wide receivers coach. He's never coached any other positions. He's never been an offensive coordinator. He's apparently just all he wants to do is coach receivers. But he's been all over. He was at Boise State and Western Kentucky. He was at Eastern Washington, where he was Cooper Kupp's coach. He was, at Washington for that period of time. And like, you know, everywhere he goes, he coaches really well. You know, his wide receivers perform, he sort of identify a couple different technique out of wide receivers, like how they protect the ball, how they catch, what their catch radius is, you know, if the ball's not totally on their numbers, what their yards after contact is like, you know, how tough they go into contact. And like, you watch in a film and you can like pick up these patterns and you're like, okay, that's coaching. When I see the same technique from multiple players across multiple schools over 20 years, like, okay, that's coaching, you know? And so I was sort of like, yeah, this guy can coach. And then I sort of devoted some of the article to solving the mystery of why was Washington's wide receiver production so bad in 2019. And like, I probably wouldn't have spent that much time on it if it wasn't Washington, but like it was. And so I had to, I'm writing for an Oregon site. But you know, I solved that mystery. Go and read that article. I feel, and frankly, you know, Washington's wide receivers was the best thing that was going for him in 2021. Like if you go back and read, you know, my film study of Washington back when we had no idea that Junior Adams was going to come to Oregon. And so like, I couldn't possibly be a homer about this. Like if anything, if I were a homer, I'd have all my incentives to like make fun of him. Right. But I wasn't making fun of him. I was repeatedly saying like Washington's wide receivers is the best part of this team. That's how they got themselves back into like the Arizona game, was hitting the, you know, these deep passes and so forth. Like, you know, so anyway, the point of all the story has been like, I went on a long journey to demonstrate that Junior Adams is a good wide receiver coach, but everybody just took for granted that he was a great recruiter, right? And then, you know, this last month or so is just like, yeah, no, you know, no cap, like he really is, man. Like he locked down a lot of pretty impressive talent.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, it definitely comes into play where you need coaches to kind of prove themselves on the recruiting trail and on the field. And then that leads to the next segment where we're talking about defense, because, you know, our new head coach, Dan Lanning, his forte is defense. We just saw what his defense did to, you know, Nick Saban's Alabama team. So we know that he's already got some good coaching chops, even at a young age. The question was, you know, how well was he going to be able to recruit as the head coach? Was he going to be able to help bring in the kind of defensive players we need? Well, it looks like that Oregon has just now jumped into the top 20, and they're sitting just outside the top 15 for the 2023 recruiting classes. And one of the reasons for that was they just had another good commitment from a four-star defensive back, Cody DeCombra. He was in line for Oregon mostly, but he had offers from Oregon State and Washington, which, again, I love to bring up because of the fact that, you know, we got him and they didn't. The kid looks pretty sturdy.
That kid must have been from Portland, though, right?
Yeah. He looks pretty sturdy, too. As a senior in high school, he's already 6 feet, 175 pounds. That's a good size for a defensive back. And odds are he'll grow a little more, get a little heavier. And the nice thing is he's very fast and very athletic. I put in my article that he posted a 4.53 in the 40, and he has a 39.8-inch vertical leap. So that's a good catch, pardon the pun again, for the defense. And then moving forward from that, like I said, we're kind of sitting just outside the top 15 as far as the 2023 class goes. next haul that we're going to have in. So keep your eyes peeled for the weekend of June 24th. That's apparently going to be just kind of like a recruiting palooza weekend for Oregon. They have lots of talent coming in from various different positions, 4- and 5-star recruits. We have running back Richard Young, offensive tackle Caden Proctor, defensive end Jaden Wayne, defensive lineman David Hicks. And we just found out this weekend that another young man that'll be making his way to Eugene once again is a 5-star defensive end, Mateo Ugalele. And he is scheduled to have his first, quote, official visit during the weekend of the 24th. But he's actually been to Eugene several times already, which obviously shows his interest, obviously shows his comfort level with the coaching staff. He does have official visits still to, you know, general ones that steal all the 5-stars, you know, USC, Ohio State, Alabama. But I think one thing, like I mentioned before, to look for is that the fact that he's already been to Eugene multiple times. But this would be a huge, huge get for Oregon if they can land this kid. He is the number one defensive end and number 5 player overall in the class of 2023.
The thing that impresses me, I mean, you're right about that weekend of the 24th. Like, it's an incredible amount of talent. Is that, like, unlike a lot of schools that recruit well, real well, and then you know, drill down and you're like, this is all skill, this is all like wide receivers and defensive backs, you know, the stuff that the West Coast is just crawling with 4-star talent. And like, yeah, you know, you need those guys. You want to make a national championship run. Good luck doing it without, you know, blue chips, wide receiver and cornerback. But like, the other thing that you need, you know, to have, well, you need to have a complete team. And the hard thing to do on the West Coast is the guys in the trenches. And that's where, you know, that's what really impresses me about this, you know, like, you know, Caden Proctor, Miles McVay, Terrence Green, all offensive linemen, right? Jaden Wayne, Uyangalele, as you mentioned, Mikhail Gardner, Blake Purchase, you know, defensive lineman, Blake Nicholson, Akana. There's, you know, other, you know, Blake Nicholson, the linebacker, Riley Williams is a tight end, you know, like it is almost exclusively, you know, the uglies, you know, right? Like offensive linemen, defensive linemen, tight ends, linebackers, the guys doing blocking and tackling the dirty work, you know, kind of guys. And it was one of the things, you know, Slurms and I were joking around about at the end of last podcast is like, you know, it's funny to read other fan bases commentary about Oregon because like, you know, it's so upside down. Like, you know, every fan base in the world, you know, portrays Oregon as this, you know, glitzy, high flying, you know, flashy program. And like, no, nah, man, the reason why it's successful is because they do real well in the trenches and they are recruiting real well in the trenches and they are bringing in disproportionately high number of dudes, you know, in the trenches for this big recruiting weekend on the 24th. You know, obviously they're not going to get all of them. Like, I hope we're not getting everybody's high, you know, hopes too high, but like, you know, you ain't gonna get, you know, anybody if you don't get them on campus, right? Like, you know, is sort of, again, like the law of averages. Like, you get enough dudes interested, you're gonna come away with a substantial fraction of them, and if, you know, and if most of those dudes are the guys doing the dirty work, then like, you're gonna look pretty good in the trenches. You know, it's just hard, you know, it's hard to avoid that conclusion, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's been nice to see in recent years, Oregon kind of like moving more towards that kind of like, you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust kind of, you know, trench battle thing. I think in the, you know, late 2000s, early 2010s, there was, you know, kind of a level of excitement around the program that we'd never seen before. And all of that was based on kind of what you said, like the glitz, the flash, like, you know, how are you going to stop Oregon? They put up, you know, 50 something points a game easy, like, you know, their offense is a blur. And, you know, we got close for sure. But then, you know, rewind and look at the it's, you know, it's tough to revisit it. But the 2014 national championship game, you know, that was probably the most loaded team we've ever had as far as skill position players goes. But Ohio State just said, hey, you know, we're going to take skill position out of it
and we're just going to run the ball down your throats and push you all over the field.
Yeah,
and just,
in particular, like linebacker, defensive line, the sexy stuff for defensive line Oregon had for a long time, but in terms of just like the beef to stand and take it, you know, in the middle to stop methodical runs, like, nah, they just didn't have it. And, you know, that was the problem. Every time they get to the heights, you know, they, you know, unless Oregon could get a knockout blow, you know, with the Chip Kelly stuff, and then put the opponent on their heels where they start making mistakes. Cause that's the flip side of the equation is, you know, Nick Aliotti's defense, where it's like, once you start getting in desperation mode and start making mistakes, they can be real opportunistic. But if you're talking about a toe-to-toe slug match, like, nah, that team wasn't built to do that because the recruiting wasn't there. And so, like, I think everybody who had like a long-term view of what Oregon was building itself to knew that, you know, the Mario Cristobal phase was the next phase of what Oregon football would have to go through in order to take the next step. And I, you know, I'm invoking a name I know, which a lot of Duck fans are still in their feelings about, but like, you all knew that that had to happen, didn't you? Like, you know, was that the guy who's going to win you a natty? Who knows? You know, we'll never know at that point. At this point, it's not like he's going to ever come back to Oregon. But like, you had to do this, you know, and Dan Lanning seems to, you know, maybe be the perfect guy to pick up that gauntlet to take the next step, because like, yeah, this is where, you know, the game's won in the trenches and the game is run with recruiting. And so therefore, put two and two together, you got to recruit well in the trenches. And I mean, I look around at a lot of teams in the conference where it's like, they don't seem to have learned that lesson, you know, like they're like, well, oh man, we can finish with the top 10 class if all we do is recruit wide receivers and cornerbacks. So yeah, let's do that. That'll impress everybody. So speaking of one such team that has totally fallen apart in the trenches, the article that I published this week was about Stanford. Boy, oh boy, Adam, but like it was crazy to review their roster, like just how total of a collapse it is on both the offense and the defense. I don't suppose you read my article on Stanford, did you?
Yeah, I did. And honestly, I think you're right. It's just like I said, I haven't seen an overhaul like that in quite some time. But honestly, I'll go ahead and take it given our recent history against Stanford. Stanford football, for whatever reason, has been a perpetual thorn in Oregon's side for the last decade or so.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's like they were two in like in 2018 and in 2021. They were not. That wasn't a good team, and yet they still beat Oregon on some pretty crazy stuff, right? And like, man, you know, it's probably just coincidence, you know, or probably like David Shaw, Wiley Fox, like never count him out. If you start self-destructing, he'll definitely be there to take advantage. But just like, you know, the crazy thing to me is like, you know, we were just saying about how Oregon was built, you know, to have all the skill players and good quarterback play and some decent cornerbacks, but sort of that's it. And the good teams that are built well in the trenches will take advantage of you. It's crazy because that's like Oregon 2010 is what Stanford looks like right now. But Stanford's worse. Like Stanford, all of their skill is in their quarterback, and they've got a good wide receiver core, and they've got a really good cornerback, and like everything in the middle of the field, you know, the defensive line, the linebackers, the offensive line is just, I mean, it's a dumpster fire. Like, and I mean, it's crazy to, you know, to the extent where they've like, they've changed their defensive system on paper, to they're calling it a 4-3, you know, it's not, it's a 2-4-5. And they have to do that because they have, I'm not joking about this, three scholarship defensive linemen who have a combined lifetime three tackles between them. Yeah. Like it's like in 2020, there were, because of the COVID protocols, you know, one of the reasons why you might have to forfeit a game was that you didn't have enough defensive linemen to play. Like you need to have X number of people who are qualified to play defensive linemen. Otherwise football doesn't work. Like you can't sub in and have like, well, we'll have linebackers play defensive linemen. Like people will get killed. Like the, you know, it's simply not safe to play a football game if you don't have an adequate number of defensive linemen. Stanford might need to forfeit some games in 2022 because they don't have an adequate number of defensive linemen, and not for COVID reasons. Like, it blows my mind that they're in this situation with their defensive. They have three scholarship defensive linemen, Adam, like three, like, and they're three stars. Like, they lost all their four stars. And you know, they're probably going to have to play walk-ons pretty substantially. Like, they're not going to be able to stop the run at all. Like, I mean, it's crazy.
No, and I think the recipe against Stanford at this point is simple: run it down their throats. They're not stopping it.
And their linebackers, their outside linebackers might actually not be bad, but like, you know, just who cares? Running up the middle, the outside linebackers are going to have anything to say about that. Their inside linebackers stink. They stunk last year. They stunk for 5 years. Like, they're, you know, it's crazy. And you're right. You know, they're just, people are just going to run on them all day long. And then the other weird thing is the offensive line. They've got lots of dudes. They didn't lose a single dude. They're all highly rated. Like, Stanford has the best, you know, net talent or average talent rating for the offensive line unit compared to anybody else in the Pac-12. And yet their performance was on the floor of all of FBS in like every stat in on my tally sheet. Like, it was just crazy. Like, how, you know, I don't really think they're busts either. Like, you would have to be exceptionally bad luck to recruit that well and then for them all to be busts. Like, that one comes down to coaching, and like, Stanford doesn't, I mean, their offensive line coaching has been terrible. I mean, it's like, would you have believed that if I said that to you about Stanford 10 years ago?
Oh, like, absolutely not. Yeah, that was their bread and butter, was winning in the trenches. And that's, you know, kind of like, along with, like I said, the debacle against Ohio State, I think they were one of the reasons that Oregon decided they had to start changing course and being like, okay, we got to start playing more bully ball because we're getting pushed around by some of these teams.
No, it's absolutely crazy. You know, every team that recruits poorly, you know, you can find their fans on Twitter chirping about how, like, oh, it doesn't matter that all we got was a bunch of 2 and 3 stars. We developed so much better than you guys do. And I don't care that you recruited a bunch of 4 stars. Like, you can't develop at all, so we'll win. And like, we all know how that goes. But they're not exactly wrong. Like, in the sense that, like, your coaching still matters. You don't get to just get 4 stars and then, you know, hit the golf course. Your job is done. You know, you have to actually develop them. And if you want a poster child for that, look at Stanford's offensive line talent rating versus performance. Like, I'm not joking about this. In more than a decade of charting teams, and not just the Pac-12, you know, all over the country, I have never in my career seen a discrepancy that bad between recruiting ranking and performance for any unit or any football team in any year. Like, it is absolutely insane that this has happened. And it didn't just come out of nowhere, you know, in 2021. It's been the case since 2018. I've never seen anything like it. It's crazy. And like, you know, let this be a lesson to, you know, everybody, like, invest in your offensive line coach. Like, I know it's not a sexy position. Nobody notices it. But I'm telling you from reviewing film, like, a poor offensive line developer, will really hurt you. And not being able to, like, guarantee consistent offensive line technique, like, there's no better way to squander talent, than that. And here's the other lesson that I've learned. Oh, man, I said this on previous podcasts, but every day I get more evidence of this. You do not fix offensive line problems through the transfer portal.
No.
Just about every other position, you can parachute in a dude. You can parachute in a running back and a linebacker and cornerbacks and wide receivers, and it's all fine. You can even, to some extent, do the defensive line. In fact, arguably with the defensive line, the defensive line is sort of a position kind of like quarterback where the scheme and the structure of the side of the ball that you play on is actually pretty relevant to you. So like, you could be a dude who fits in a 3-down scheme, but you signed up for a 4-down team and it's like, I need to get out of here and go somewhere where my body type, you know, is a better fit for. And then they do real well there. So like, just One example off the top of my head, Marquez Bimage, who was an outside linebacker for Texas, when they fired, he was developed by Todd Orlando when he was their defensive coordinator at Texas. When he got fired, they switched back to a four, and so he didn't fit, and he was like, I want to go to a place that's a three. He found Cal and instantly came in and was like their best outside linebacker in years at Cal. He immediately eclipsed everybody because it was the correct, scheme fit for his body. So that happens on, that's the sort of the one position, and the other one is quarterback. You see it all the time where a transfer quarterback like parachutes in and like, he just, I don't know what it is, frankly. Like I wasn't a college quarterback, so I can't tell you exactly, but like, so, you know, they just like, they didn't get along with the previous staff or something. But like they click with the new staff and they light it up. Yeah. I mean, we've seen multiple national championships won over the last several years by transfer quarterbacks. Right.
Oh yeah. And even in our own conference, when you look back on guys like Vernon Adams Jr. and Garner mm-hmm. Minshew, who just came in taking over for legendary guys in their programs, and then the teams didn't miss a beat.
Yeah. I mean, it does. You can't guarantee that it's going to happen. Like you can't say, oh, you were a four-star and you underperformed at your last school and you transferred to a new school, so therefore you're going to overperform like that. You can't make that guarantee, but it is the one position. Well, two position, the other one being defensive line, as I just finished rambling about, the one position where you can, where you sort of like throw out the record books for a transfer is quarterback. So like the obvious import to this for Oregon fans is Bo Nix, who's averaging like a 120 NCAA passer rating, which is it is within the bell curve. It's one standard deviation, but on the lower side. It's not like grossly low where you're like, oh my God, this is terrible, but it's like, you would want that to be more like 140. If you're talking about a dude who can lead you to championships, but like, man, I don't know. I was watching a lot of Auburn tape. Obviously Oregon played him in 2019. And then for other projects, I've wound up having to watch Auburn. Like for example, they play Georgia every year. I've been doing some Georgia film study, and a few other teams where I wound up watching Auburn, quite a bit. That team had no offensive line and no wide receivers. Like it was bizarre how much, like I've got a good friend of mine was an Auburn student, and I rib this person all the time about like, why doesn't this team have offensive linemen or wide receivers? It's a daily joke that I'm making about this team, or weekly whenever we watch on Saturdays. Bo Nix, I cannot guarantee that this is going to happen, but the factors that have been present for other transfer quarterbacks who go from not performing up to their recruiting rankings at school A, then transfer to school B. And you look at the factors like more quarterback friendly offense, better offensive line protection, better wide receivers, scheme change that may be more in line with their abilities. Like all of those factors are present for Nix transferring to Oregon. So again, please don't read this as a guarantee, but we've seen this sort of thing work out before plenty of times, not just like once or twice, plenty of times, to the extent that anybody who says like, oh, we know who Bo Nix is, no, you don't. You don't know Bo. but anyway, the position that you did not hear me mention as, oh, you can fix this through the portal, is the offensive line. And I mean, in this interview series that we're doing, and like you can find it on Twitter all over the place, you can find it in podcasts that are not me, you will find every fan is saying like, yeah, there's kind of an offensive line problem, but they're hoping to fix it in the transfer portal. No, you're not. Like, or that's not a realistic hope. Like name one, like come at me, like name an effective offensive line transfer. Like,
yeah,
there's actually, I could name them if anybody was really curious, but like, you can't.
No, of course
you don't. You need one hand to count them.
It comes into just because there is no more importance of cohesion possibly in anywhere in any sport than an offensive line in football. The cohesion and the chemistry, that has to be a unit. They have to be. It is not something where you can mix and match and plug different players in. You see it all the time. You saw it in the 2019 Rose Bowl team for Oregon. That was a group that had been together for four straight years. They knew each other. They had that cohesion. You know, you saw it with the offensive line that helped protect Marcus Mariota in his last year. Same thing. Group of upperclassmen, cohesion, familiarity. It is not something where you can just mix and match and plug guys in.
Yeah. And like, to the extent that there are any dudes who are good enough to play for you, want to play for you, and have the magical ability to like just jump right in and develop that cohesion with their teammates right away. Like, that dude's a unicorn, man. Like, there's not enough of those guys to go around. There's maybe one of them. Like, there's not the 30 of them that, you know, every single podcast, you've got a kid or, you know, a team talking about getting a kid out of the portal to play in their offensive line. There's not enough of them, guys. You know, somebody's going to get one, and, you know, that'll be the exception that proves the rule. But like all these teams, you know, so my point being, you can sort of, the portal means you can sort of screw up your roster balance at every other position, and you can fix it through the portal. Like, you know, USC is doing a lot of fixing through the portal right now. The exception is offensive line. You know, yep. If there's one position, like if your team needs to be burned to the studs and there's one position that you're salvaging and moving on with, make it your offensive line. You know how I know that? It's because what happened in 2016 at Oregon, right? Yep. Like that 2016 Oregon team need to be burned to the ground. But you know what the last gift of Mark Helfrich was? It was Calvin Throckmorton. You know, and the rest of that, you know, offensive line group, that mm-hmm. got, you know, Mario Cristobal through the Rose Bowl. Like, you know, and so for all, you know, all these other, you know, teams that sort of want, you know, that I keep interviewing that are like, yeah, we're going to have a quick resurgence. Well, did you fix your offensive line? Oh no. But it'll be fine. And I'm like, it's not going to be fine.
No, absolutely yeah. not.
All right. I think that's going to do it for us this week, or we'll wrap it up here. Adam, it's been a pleasure talking to you. What are you looking forward to for next week?
Definitely looking forward to the track and field championships. I think that should be a lot of fun. I think that hosting them at Hayward Field is definitely going to be a big thing. Like I said, have a little bit of excitement about Oregon's first round matchup in the regionals baseball wise. Beyond that, don't have a whole lot of hope. As we move through the summer, like I said, we're just going to keep breaking down some film and breaking down recruiting over football, and it'll be here before you know it. So, yeah, should be a good time.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.